Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, a little bit later than usual, and I appreciate the flexibility. Will Cosentini joins me from outside Kansas City. Will, how are you?
Morning, Mac. I'm good.
That's good. That's good. And Tim Lynch joins me from McAllen, Texas. Timmy, how are you? Take your microphone off mute. Hello? I just heard something. Hello? Lynch?
Hey, I can't barely hear you because I've got another line in my headphones.
Oh, that's your story this time? The, all right. You're okay, though. You can hear now.
I've still got one more. There's another interview playing.
There's another interview playing someplace. Okay. I don't know where the hell that is. The, are you sure it's me? Is it, might it
no,
be?
No, it's,
it might be you. Might be from a web page or something like that. All right. And then, so we'll get Timmy unscrewed. And then Jeff Kenny joins me from someplace in Southern California, I think. Jeff, how are you?
Good, Mac. Yeah. I'm down here in San Clemente.
Got it. All right. The Timmy, you good? You back?
Yep. I'm back. It was me.
Okay. All right. The I just played an interview, and I sent it to these guys last night before everybody heard it today, from a Marine that I met 20 months ago. It's his interview is an incredible story, and we've all you know experienced suicide in our life. So that's going to be what we talk about here for a little bit. Now I don't want to go Tim Lynch and get emotional, right? I was talking to people at the National Museum of the Marine Corps yesterday. And they want to interview me for their all their guides and stuff like that. So the woman, her name's Nala, she said, "I'm really interested, Mac, because this isn't your field, yet you're so passionate about it." She said, "When I saw you do this, that's one of the things that comes blasting off the stages." And she says, "I'm just so curious about how, you know," so I'm sitting here talking right to her, and I go Tim Lynch. I start getting emotional. I'm like, shit, with all the remorse that goes with Tim Lynch emotion, right? So it's two emotions rolled into one. One is getting emotional, and two is the remorse that I'm not supposed to be emotional. So I'm straight up going Tim Lynch. She didn't even ask me the question. But the answer to the question is, if you could see what I've seen, you would know. If you could see their courage and selflessness in the shittiest places on the planet, under the shittiest conditions, right? Will's guys, orange. They were covered in orange dust from head to fucking toe, right? And upbeat, motivated to go out and do their job, even after they got thrown out of the chow hall. Where at was that Blue Diamond? Where did they get thrown out of the chow hall, Will?
Oh no! They didn't get thrown out. Everyone kept their respectful distance until we were done.
So the issue of suicide and is something that, you know, is more and more prevalent in our society, and so I wanted to talk about it with these guys, because we did one of these about how do you handle death a couple months ago, and it's really interesting. We could talk about international affairs and all kinds of shit, but the shows that get the most response from people are the shows that we talk about stuff that everybody deals with, that everybody relates to. So So, Will, I'll start with you. You heard that interview. Your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I wrote three things down. Two of them really reinforce things that you've said in it. Kuiker, no trauma in the Marine Corps.
No.
No Marine Corps trauma. Second thing is it's not apparent that he has any infrastructure damage, right? He had trauma. He doesn't have psychosis. And so in many ways, the classic case for post-traumatic winning. And the third thing is a question I wrote down that, you know, you and I have talked about before. And a little bit of the problem with Kuiker is everyone else looks around and says, "Well, look at that guy. I don't have trauma like that. I can't be that bad." Right. And so you measure yourself and what you've gone through against really a horrific case. And it maybe you want to downplay some problem, some issue that you've had. That may push you away from, I don't necessarily need to think the way McNamara proposes it in post-traumatic winning. And it's a slight danger. And I just say you gotta keep beating the drum that, yeah, trauma is trauma is trauma. And don't always measure yourself against yourself, not against that other case that's out there.
Yeah, but you hear people say that all the time, right? But I'm not.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. And that's what I say when I, you know, again, you and I had this conversation a month ago, about this. And that could be a slight danger, but you're aware of that danger.
Well, you know, it's interesting though, Will. Well, and let me just tell you about the Will calls me and says, "Hey, I got a question for you." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "Do you think there's a difference between tragic and trauma?" Was that it, Will? And is there time?
Yeah, the difference between tragedy and trauma.
And is there a time element to this? And so really what Will's at, he's got his X-Acto knife out, right? And he's, you know, you think about this because if you've lived through this, right? It's not like it goes away, you know, and you hear things and they rattle around in the washing machine of your head, right? As we chew on them. And so it's am I that person? Am I in that group or am I not in that group? Or is my experience just a little bit different? Will, so explain that from your perspective because it was an interesting conversation.
Yeah, you know, I mean, my story's been out on the show a few times. My wife very suddenly passed away a year and a half ago now. And then, you know, I lost my job in January very suddenly. And Mac, you know, says those are classic traumatic events. And I guess they are. And I feel that I'm just in a lot better place than a whole lot of other people. You know, I'm financially stable. I have very strong family connections. I think I do. And I don't necessarily feel traumatized. And I've also just put some governors in my life, to ensure that I don't ever get close to the edge. And I said, so was that really trauma? As opposed to tragedy, because look, everyone in your life, people die, and that's tragic. And Mac makes the point that no, that's trauma. And you do have to deal with it. And maybe, excuse me, maybe because of my life circumstances, it's easier for me to deal with and understand, you know, I was 56 years old when this thing sort of started and had a certain amount of experience and also some study and other things. But I can't, I, you know, as I'm looking at the post-traumatic winning stuff, I said, is that necessarily for me? And then he says, no, it's trauma. And I look at it again and I say, yeah, you know, you're right. It is.
Well, I asked him a question. I asked him a question. I said, is there a time limit that goes with it? Because there's people that didn't go through your experience that would look at your experience and say, holy shit. And I said, so what's the time limit, Will? And Will said, because he's a smart guy, he said, good point. He said, good point. So, no, but I mean, I think those are the mature discussions that you begin to have when you begin to go down this road with people that aren't afraid of the truth, that will people that will consider this and think about it, right? My point.
Yeah, yeah.
The all right, Timmy, you heard that interview. Your thoughts?
The one thing that you guys didn't cover this time was that for Kiker, he responded to a lot of this malfunction in his house by becoming an auto mechanic and earning enough certifications to make a pretty successful living on his own. And so, you know, a guy like that comes into the Marine Corps, and what you want to think will happen is like, you know, a hillbilly elegy where that guy blossoms and leaves the Marine Corps and becomes a very successful lawyer and writer. And instead he's drinking two bottles of Jack a day. You've got to be shitting me. That part is disappointing. There's no way that any Marines in a rifle company could have done that, obviously. But it's disappointing that although his peers at one point apparently rallied and helped him on the way to sobriety, it was after General Furness had told him that was what he's going to do. And so it was nice, you know, it's a great story, but that was a very perceptive kid, and that's probably one of the reasons why I think he responded so quickly. He's not a dummy. You know what I mean? But when you have that many strikes against you, I've heard some, you know, horrific stories about childhood. I've not heard anything that was quite that dramatic. And for most of us, suicide is a very strange thing. But the other thing I was thinking of was the one suicide that I had to deal with in the Marine Corps was a sergeant. And we were going out on a crest, and he was supposed to have an appointment with what I thought was marriage counseling with his wife. And it wasn't. It was therapy. And he was going to come back, check his rifle out of the Army, go sit in the duty hut and wait for a ride to the field. And he checked his rifle out of the Army and got back in his car and drove home and shot himself. And it turned out that he had had a horribly abusive childhood, the issues that he's been struggling with for many a year. And we at the command had not one fucking clue. We had no idea that this was what was going on. And felt that would have been had been a tremendous disservice to us to allow us to try to do something, and if nothing else, to not allow him to check a rifle out by himself. But you know, at the time, what worry we have? He's a sergeant. He was a very effective squad leader.
Right.
It was a tragedy, and I don't think you'll see that today. But it's a damn shame that it took your intervention and a CG to get a guy that we should have been helping before. That was the one thing I just can't get away from.
Well, it's interesting. And before, you know, we bring Jeff in, you know, what two of the general officers, the general officers that appear in post-traumatic winning, there's three of them. There's Admiral Stockdale, there's General Mattis, and Major General Furness. General Mattis says, if you don't love them, then you need to get out, right? And then General Furness says, you've got to know the key to this is knowing them better. And so I then say, look, you know, here's guys with, what, 80-plus years of leadership experience, and I don't know how many combat deployments between them, probably over 20. And one of them saying love them, and the other one saying know them better, of all the things they could tell you. And so to me, what you're talking about, Timmy, is – you know, we go to work with them, but do you know them? Do you know them? And one of the things that I love about the mature conversations like this one about suicide and about mental health that you begin to have when you're saying, all right, we're going to talk about it, is how do we teach the majority of our junior Marines who are doing the counseling, lieutenants and sergeants? How do we teach? Do we teach them to counsel? The answer is no. We teach them about the performance evaluation system, but we don't teach them how to have a conversation. The only people that get taught how to have a conversation are recruiters. And so there's a fix in them, because one of the things that Dave Furness says is we need them to get the leadership 401. They're capable out of the chute of 101 and 201. How do we get them to 401? Well, somebody's got to have a kneecap-to-kneecap conversation with him about this is the conversation that you have to have. These are the questions that you got to ask. And that person probably ought to be the first sergeant, right? And so, but nobody taught me how to counsel anybody. I just, you know, I kind of figured that out, or I didn't. But I will tell you this, I could have been so much better. I could have known them so much better if somebody would have led me down that path and said, if you do this, you'll get to know them. When you get to know them, you'll be able to impact their lives. Once you impact their lives, guess what you will be? You'll be their leader, not just the next jackass in charge. So with all that said, go ahead.
You know, and that's all true, but I think it's also incumbent on the mental health people to give somebody a heads up when they're dealing with somebody who's dealing with some horrific problems and they're not coping well. Like I said, and I don't know if it's a patient's rights issue or what have you. I know that the mental health people can only notify your command if they think that you're going to hurt yourself or somebody else.
Right,
and
they're required
at that point
to.
They did not, but we still should have known.
They're required to.
Done something.
But again, there's been this fight between mental health professionals and commands, because the perception among mental health professionals is if we tell them, they're going to fire this dude out of the Marine Corps, and this dude does not want to leave, right?
No. Yeah.
And so that's not the
way it goes down at all. We could have helped.
Right. We want to help. Jeff, thoughts on the interview?
Well, two things jump out at me. One observation and then another one question. First one, the observation, he really hits the nail on the head as he's going through, you know, his spiel about this stuff, talking to you. He says, I didn't really start coming out of this in reality until I started helping other people. And he kind of talks a little bit like about as if he had spoken to Frankel. Of course, he spoke to you, and Frankel comes out. You know, but the idea that, you get kind of like redemption from helping somebody else. It's like a reverse effect of the remember you were talking, Mac, last week about the guy. You're standing around a bunch of guys at one of the LZs, the TBS, saying, you know, the fact is that guys who get abused and their kids grow up to abuse their kids. And then the guy said, that's bullshit.
Jeff Weiss.
And I agree, you know, but he's saying – what this kid is saying is like, I didn't really start coming out of this until I got the first the ambition and then the actuality of trying to help other people out of it. So because he knows that the biggest obstacle, and you guys just brought it up, to getting help when you need it is saying you need help. Because otherwise he's just a drunk guy who's a fucking pain in the ass. And the truth is, you know, most of us, including me, we're pissed at guys like that because, you know, they get all the attention. Whereas we got guys who they never get fucked up and they never let it interfere with their job, and they're always there on time and they're always doing the right thing, and yet somebody's bending over backwards to deal with some guy who's going to parole, you know, but the way he brought it out is like his two buddies said to him, finally, we don't like you anymore, and you need to start fixing yourself. And then combined with, you know, him actually being there at post-traumatic winning and then having a little private thing with you, which turned into a private thing with Dave, you know, that he's lucky that way, you know? Right. The question I have is, and I don't want to get, you know, just, you know, off the subject, but what was his dad on medication for? Because I'm curious about that. You know, what was the problem with his dad that he had all that medication that he took in his first attempt at suicide? You know, Mac, did you go through that with him?
No, I don't know. I have heard him say that his mother believed that they had screwed the medications up. The medications had actually made him worse.
Yeah, I'm kind of dealing with a situation like that right now. That's why I was curious about it. You know, how did that
– A not uncommon theme. in these situations.
These guys get from when I was in the hospital, I noticed that they're very aggressive at giving you drugs. And so, you know, if you have drugs for pain, that's one thing, because you get off drugs for pain. You get weaned off them. And old guys, they'd say, old guys meaning guys like you guys, you know, guys who came in like during the 80s and stuff, they want to get off as soon as they can because they don't like the idea. But the younger guys, they want the stuff because they've been raised differently when it comes to that type of medicine. But then there's other stuff they give them a lot of times under the rubric of PTSD drugs and you know, problems you have. You just don't feel good. They give you drugs instead of talking to you. Or they give you drugs in concert with that. And that's what I was curious about. You know what I'm saying? Like I said, I don't want to take away from the main thrust of this thing. But I was curious what his issue was. Chris Bronzy walked by just now a ways, by the way. But, what was it that he was going through? Because we don't want this thing to turn into that thing that Captain Jeff, whatever, you know, said, that's bullshit. What? Maybe we could stop that. That guy, he's at risk. Tried to kill himself using the thing that was supposed to help him, and then finally just shot himself. Right. And took him 3 shots to get the nerve to do it. Right. And that's the other thing I wanted to say, just you know, observation about the kid, the kid's prescience, Kiker, about being able to see that his dad, you know, it takes guts to fucking end your own life. It takes nerve to end your own life, but it takes guts to get through the problem that makes you want to do that and go on. And it seems like a contradiction, but it really isn't.
It is. When you first hear it, hey, wait,
first
that's
hear
a contradiction.
It seems like it.
But you know what?
The difference between nerve and courage, you know right. what I mean? You know what I mean? Like, you have the nerve to do something. You have nerve to go up and ask a girl, would you like to have sex with me? But it takes courage to marry her and then live your whole goddamn life with her, you know? So it's like, and there's a lot of things, you know, nerves, like, you know, running from point A to point B under fire, maybe. But courage is, you know, it goes on and on all day, you know, and you're doing it all day. That's different, you know. And so he kind of hits that fine point pretty good, I thought.
And, you know, that interview might be one of the best interviews I've ever done in my life. And what's incredible about it is just his – that's him as a 22-year-old, 23-year-old guy here in the United States. And some of his language is not PC. Right? It's a bitch move. You know, oh, he's a pussy, right?
Yeah.
But you know what? If you won't go there and listen to that, then you really don't want to make a difference. And I thought for a half second, like, geez, should I edit that out? And I thought, hell no. People have to listen to this because his story is incredible, right? But you've got to listen. You got to be willing to go there with him. And if that's what it takes to, you know, to make you squeamish, or that would dissuade you from going there and helping, then you don't really want to help. But I love it because it is quintessentially Marine, right? It is quintessentially Marine, and then when you hear the excitement in his voice when he tells a story about that girl he used to go out with, giving him the drugs and say, "Hey, I was going to kill myself, but I don't want to anymore. Now that I met you." You're like, this kid's gone from all that suicide in his life, all that pain, and being on the verge of killing himself, to now he's doing this for other people. And it's just, I mean, he's an incredible young kid, and as Timmy said, he's a smart kid. But to me, he's a great example of if you'll go there with the truth, right, and not bullshit, that we can – We can turn them around. Now, I want to kind of switch gears because I want to get your reaction to that interview. And if there's anything else, feel free. But I want to get your thoughts on suicide itself and your personal experiences with suicide. Do you have much of it in your life? And any other thought that you have on it? And have you ever thought of suicide? So, Will, you first. Much of it in your life? Have you ever thought about it? Your thoughts about suicide?
You know, I don't really have much of it in my life. And it's funny because I've really been trying to go through the history books. When me and Jeff were in EI Company, we lost a Marine who'd actually just left the company. He was in a combat engineer platoon and had PCS'd, or he might have been going to a school or something in Mainside, but he was out of the unit. And I can see his face. I can't remember his name. He wasn't there long with us. And I didn't know the rest of the story. And I was really grinding on that last night, just trying to remember it. I just don't know it. And then we had another guy in the company where we came in, and I think it was on a Saturday, and the company was going to the field, and someone didn't show up, and went to the barracks room. The guy had slit his wrist, and this was an odd one. He had been kicked out of the Army, and I want to say dishonorable discharge, but it might have been bad conduct discharge. And he enlisted in the Marine Corps under his brother's name, brother's social security number, and gone to the Gulf War and came to EI Company. He was a sergeant. He was a good Marine. He was a really good Marine. He was the squad leader that you wanted. And apparently the IRS had gone to his brother and said, hey, you owe us a bunch of taxes, because his brother was getting two income streams on his on a social security number, one from the guy who'd stolen his ID, and completely out of the blue to us. And, you know, so we hiked him up to Bethesda, and I went up there a few times, and the guy was like, he had nothing. The only thing he had that he'd done well in his life was the Marine Corps. Yeah. And, you know, so in our wisdom, we kicked him out.
Yeah, he was one of Ralph Denker's
And it was a really... I remember it was a really empty feeling, because I'm a pretty junior captain, and trying to talk to the battalion commander, who's a lieutenant colonel, and CEO of TBS, who's a full-bird colonel, that this is a good Marine. And it was like, there's nothing we can do. And I mean, I had nothing for the guy. It was really sort of empty. And you know, for me personally, it's hard for me to imagine a world without me in it. So I'm the last guy that you're gonna think about that. And you know, even in the last year and a half, I've never, you know, I don't me and my wife never had this conversation. I'll tell you, I think that if the situation was reversed, the only thing that I would want for her is to be happy. And so I try and live, that way. And you know, it's there every day for me. She's here every day for me. But it's not an unhappy, feeling. It's painful, on certain days and at certain times. But I'm not going to be, unhappy. But again, I do some things. I'm very sparing, in how I drink, and I try and stay connected, with other people, and I try and be productive. And so I put some guardrails out there to make sure I don't ever really get close to the edge. But I can't say I've ever really thought about it. So that's me.
Got it. Timmy?
Well, the you know, suicide was just such a rare thing when we were growing up. I had a childhood friend whose father was an airline pilot, and they moved away when we were like fifth grade, and I heard subsequently that his father had committed suicide. And I remember thinking about that for years and years. It's the weirdest goddamn thing. I mean, why would somebody, I had no understanding. And then when I was in the EMT, I remember running a call once for an obvious suicide. It was an Iranian woman who had gone up behind her house, and she had taken poison or something. It wasn't any obvious trauma, but she was obviously dead by the time we got there. And we didn't even get close. You know, we kind of backed off. It was something you just didn't talk about. Nobody ever really much thought about. And when I had in the Marine Corps was such an anomaly, you know, that one sergeant, if we felt like shit, we should have known. We ended up being pissed at the medical guys, and they were in turn pissed at us. But it wasn't until I was in Kabul with a guard force trying to shepherd through these fucking guard force of Peruvians that couldn't even speak English. And I'm having all these problems trying to teach them how to shoot a damn rifle and stuff. It was a disaster. And I had two problem children. One of them was a broken heart guy. His girlfriend had wrote him a Dear John letter or something like that, as near as I could decipher. And the other guy had some kind of an open sore on his leg that he said he needed Valium for. And I'm like, oh, fuck. And at any rate, so but these two were like roommates or something. Somehow they had ended up together because nobody else wanted to be in their rooms with them in guard rooms. And I separated them and I put a watch on the brokenhearted guy and left the suffering wound because I was sending him back to Peru. And that night, about 2 a.m, a bunch of the Peruvians come running over yelling, El Muerte, El Muerte. And I go booking out of there, and he's hanging off of it with his web belt off the damn catwalk. And I got to cut him down and do CPR. And we get him over to, an Italian field hospital across the way there at the airport in Kabul. And he was dead. And I caught a lot of shit for that. And the shit I caught for it was, as I explained to the RSO, why that guy was alone. I said, well, he was kind of like being a pain in the ass, and I had this broken heart guy, and I was worried about him being suicidal. And he goes, well, you don't know that people that are addicted to benzodiazepine or whatever, diazepam, that's the most lethal withdrawal you could go through? And I'm like, I had no idea. And so in retrospect, this was something which I should have been able to prevent. But I don't feel that bad about it, you know, because I feel bad that I don't carry around a lot of guilt as if I did something wrong that caused this guy to off himself. Because you know, most of us with suicide, we just don't even want to think about it. And so I did think about it, though. funny you should ask. And when I was writing my blog, when I first got back from Afghanistan, when I was recognizing the insurmountable problems I had in front of me, and I briefly thought about it, and it scared me enough. And I actually had broken ribs. I'd come back with 3 broken ribs, and my shoulder was all torn up. But I went out and I ran. I ran for almost 5 miles. Not ran, walked and ran, walked and ran, walked and ran. And I came back, and I wrote on the Free Range blog the last post, which is when it crashed the server, it went viral. Like, it was the most popular post I ever wrote, which was, I thought, an exercise in self-pity. I took it down like a week later, just disgusted with myself for having done it. But that one exercising of the demon prevented me from ever thinking about that option again. But I would say to Matt Kiker that people who are depressed, they have an inability to control intrusive thoughts. In other words, let's say that you're exercising, you're just driving aimlessly around, and all of a sudden this embarrassing thought of something you did when you were a teenager. Let's say you had an erection in public or something like that. Out of the blue, this thought comes tumbling into your head, and you're like, you feel this shame, and you're like, oh God, I cringe at this. But a reasonable guy would go, hey, wait a second, where's this coming from? If you sit and start thinking through, the hell am I thinking this for? Whatever the hell it is that's triggering negative thoughts, you can handle because you've got full possession of your faculties. A depressed person doesn't have that. Those intrusive thoughts come in and are bombarding unending cascade. And so when you once remarked about suicide, you look at it as somebody just wanting to end the pain. I believe that you're on the mark with that, because that would be the one thing I would say regarding my brief dalliance with ideations. That was a problem. Is you just got an unending cascade of intrusive thoughts, and you cannot turn it off. And I don't think that most people respond well to antidepressants and just raise their serotonin and these things go away. Generally, there's a reason you've got thoughts like this cascading in your head, and what you got to fix is the reason, not trying to balance the chemicals in your brain, because that science is no science. I have very little faith in most of those potions, and I've tried more than a few.
Well, you can see that's the path of endurance. That's the path that has taken us to the statistics that we have today, right?
Yeah.
How does that mean?
Oh, I agree. I absolutely agree. So it's a healthy thing to talk about, but as you can tell by my obvious discomfort, even today, it's not something in our society we're comfortable talking about. If we were Japanese in 1940, we'd be chatting about this shit, drinking sake every time we wanted to joke around with each other. But in our society, it isn't that way. It's such, and it's becoming a little bit more of a problem, and that's indicative of a huge problem. You know, that's not a good indice of a healthy society.
But I have to say this to me, you like controlled your emotions pretty good right there. I'm impressed.
Will's giving me the antidote. It's if Constantini's on the radio show with me, I'm not going to fucking do it because I'm not going to allow him to come back and fuck with me.
There you go. Jeff, suicide. Much experience with it in your life personally, and ever thought about it?
Yeah, I got some experience as a Marine officer with it. When I was the XO of SOI, we had a lieutenant who was going through the LAR course back in 2011 who killed himself. So I had to do the 8-day report and all that stuff. That the 8-day report is a thing you do when a suicide occurs in a command, and it goes all the way up to headquarters, Marine Corps. And this kid, he was going through this course, and he was on Liberty in San Clemente. And he was at Knucklehead's Bar with other lieutenants. They went to kind of a snake ranch. Lieutenants who had a – do you guys remember when Mel and Joe Latwell and a bunch of other guys had this – they had an apartment that was, passed down since 1972 to lieutenants. And this kid was, visiting people who lived there. So they went into Knucklehead's. They got drunk. They had an argument. He got his ass whipped by another lieutenant. And so – he said, I'm going to go, yeah, everything calmed down. Everybody shook hands and hugged each other and shit. And then he said, well, I'm going to go back to the apartment. So he went to the apartment, got his motorcycle, and decided to go back to the barracks at SOI instead of staying there. So he gets to the gate, he gets a DUI on his motorcycle. They call me, and they called the duty. And so I told the duty, go ahead and pick him up and, put him in his rack. So he did. And I talked to the kid on the phone, too, and I said, hey, are you okay? What the fuck, man? He goes, oh, sorry, I'm just so humiliated and embarrassed. I go, we'll handle it on Monday. It's not the end of the world, and, it's not good, but it's not the end of the world. And to me, it was like fist fight in a bar. The big problem I was worried about is he got a DUI, Naval Academy kid. So then he disregarded everything I told him. He went out and he was well off, this kid. He had a Blazer, and he had already checked in to 3rd LAR out in 29 Palms and then came back for the course. So he had a storage unit out there, and in the storage unit he had firearms. So he got his Blazer, and he drove out, and he got his weapon. He had a Sig Sauer 45. He got it out of his car. He was driving back along Highway 62. He took a right just past Yucca Valley, and there's a back way up to Big Bear that those of you guys who might be familiar with the area know about. And it's like more of a gentle slope getting up to the Big Bear area than going up from the ocean side, you know. And he drove off the road and flipped his vehicle. And it rolled over twice. And he's sitting in there, and people are coming running out to help him. And he opened his windows open, and a person heard him say, ah, fuck it. And he just shot himself in the head. So I had to do the report on that. And I got to know more about it than I normally would have, because I was the XO of the command. And then the battalion commander of the headquarters unit, who wasn't even part of this, but his dad is I'm not going to say his name, but his dad is a famous general hero of ours from World War II. Not his dad, his grandfather. Okay. And so he gets these lieutenants who were with this guy out on Liberty and chews their ass and basically tells them that they're the reason he's dead. And if they had been more, intrusive and shit like that. So I got a hold of him and I fucking chewed his ass, fellow lieutenant colonel. And I chewed his fucking ass and told him that he's the fucking problem with this thing. You can't pin this. Then I talked to those guys. And that's really the most intimately I was involved in a suicide recently. That was 2011. And so I think about that kid a lot, And I'm thinking, why did he have to shoot himself? Holy fuck, man. There's, maybe he just do his time in LAR, get out and become a famous Texas lawyer or something, or who the hell knows, you know. But the idea being that he would end it all like that, you almost could feel it when his car flipped, and he's like had one bad piece of luck in his mind. I mean, basically bad judgment after bad judgment, you know, getting into a fight with somebody who kicked his ass, fucking deciding to try and run the gate and getting a DUI, and then driving all the way out there to, you know, everything he did just didn't work that day. He just made a series of bad decisions, and he finally, and the first and the last decision he made was the worst one he made. So I think about that kid a lot. As far as me committing suicide, I never wanted to commit suicide, but both times I was on recruiting, enlisted and officer, in the commander recruiting, you have three guys who are under the big pressure. One is the recruiter. The other one is his NCOIC, who's responsible for, you know, putting in so many bodies a month. And the final one is this RSCO, and to a certain extent, the district commander. And so I didn't want to kill my NCOIC, and I didn't want to kill my CO, but I wanted to go up because there's minions who work for these guys who they talk shit on you, even though you're working your ass off trying to make mission. And to the you know, other people who are under pressure, and they can affect your life. And so when I thought I wasn't going to make it, and I feel sorry for myself, I think I'm going to go up and shoot both these motherfuckers, and then the cops will come and kill me, and that would be just fine because I'm a failure of a motherfucker and I deserve it. And that's both as a major in Pittsburgh and as a staff sergeant and a gunny in Colorado. So, but those are fleeting things, you know, that, you know. But I have to tell you, I was so worried about not fulfilling my mission and being known as a guy who fucking fell on his ass when other people are dependent on you, you know, because of the numbers game. If you don't put in your numbers, someone else has to put in more. And so, you know, there's that. Earlier in my family life, my cousin, my dad's oldest brother, Chester Kenny, had three sons, just like I got three sons. And the middle one was Bobby Kenny. And he kind of looked like Paul Kennedy, because there's a branch of the Kenny family. My dad's one of them. Black hair and like blue green eyes that like blazing, you know, and then when they're pissed, those eyes blaze at you. And so I'd go over there and visit. I idolize these guys. Bobby was like 4 or 5 years older than me. And they'd do shit. They'd abuse me pretty regularly. And he came up with this game called Who Can Hit the Softest? And I always won, you know? And it was that type of thing. But in the mid 80s, he just offed himself. You know, he was smart. He's magna cum laude graduate of University of Connecticut, and he went to a pretty big grad school. And you know, I couldn't fucking imagine it because he was so tough, you know, that he would do that. So I guess my feeling about suicide is, it's a mystery to me. You know, it's a mystery to me. Part of me feels like Kiker does about his dad, you know, but I have to tell you, it's just weird. Another thing, I was a MESEP. We ran PT every Friday as a unit. And we're running. There's this guy laying in the grass outside the engineering center. And, you know, there's a lot of college kids laying in the grass in Colorado in the spring. They're just drunk. They just passed out there. So we didn't pay attention. Well, it turns out it was a midshipman who threw a fucking from the eighth floor of the engineering building. He put a heavy chair or part of a couch through the window and then jumped because he wasn't doing good. And he was afraid he was going to flunk. And he was a suicide. We had to all go to briefs. I didn't know the kid very well, but he was a midshipman and he killed himself. I remember thinking though, then like I do now, there's more to this than this. The guy doesn't have any guts or, you know, he doesn't have, or that thing that Kiker said. I mean, the advantage I got over Kiker is I'm old. Right. And I've seen, you know, I've heard and seen a lot of this. And
can I tell you something? 60% of the suicide among veterans is people north of 40 years of age. So I don't know that. I mean, we say that's an advantage, but statistically, it doesn't bear that out. I was thinking about this last night because I was thinking like, okay, what am I going to talk about relative to suicide with these guys? And I've never had anybody close to me commit suicide. I haven't had a Marine in my command commit suicide. And I thought about this and thought about this last night. And I'm like, okay, well, what about here? What about here? And I mean, I've been in large organizations that obviously have had it happen, but and so But I will tell you this, and I probably haven't, I've never said this before, or maybe I have, I'm not sure, but when I came home from Afghanistan, I worked for the worst officer I've ever worked for in my life. And I was going through a divorce, which is something I never thought I would go through. And you know, my feelings of failure, were huge in that. And all that collides, right, in you alone. And I'd never thought about killing myself, but I distinctly remember thinking, this is why people do it, though.
Right.
You know, and I mean, I would never do that. First of all, I'm Catholic, and you'll go to hell. I don't need that. If that's true, I don't need that to be the cherry on top of everything. Number two, I have four kids, but I do remember thinking, yeah. Right, this black place, right, this is why people do it. This is why people do it. And I don't think if I hadn't been raised the way I was raised and to fight and to find a way and that I would go to hell. And with all that different infrastructure that was a part of me, right, I may not have had that thought, that it'd be a fleeting thought and thinking, I know this is why. And that's what caused me to go to therapy, was I was getting worse, not getting better. And I remember I called Chris Bronzy and I called Luke McConnell. And who else did I call? I called somebody else. And I asked them, hey, how do you deal with it? And interestingly enough, they all answered kind of similarly. I don't deal with it very well. I really struggle with it. So I wish I could give you a good answer, but I can't. I was like, whoa. But that was probably my first honest discussions about mental health with my peers. You know, who I'd served with and you know, closely. The relative.
Hey, Mac, before you do that, just an admin note. You know, Jeff talked about these 8-day reports. Those 8-day reports end up on the commandant's desk. He reads every one of them.
Right.
I think there was a couple of things in that. Number one, it's the people at the top of the organization attempting to generate trends, statistics, something that they can implement across the force as they learn things about it. The second thing I think is sort of an implied task, is as Jeff said, there's always more to the story. And I think by pushing that 8-day report down and making people understand that, it's sort of an implied mission to try and know your people better. Because I'll tell you, when you're sitting up there at the top, I don't think General Amos or General Dufford gave a shit what the Secretary of Defense was going to say about suicide. They actually gave a shit because they did give a shit about it. But you struggle when you're at the top of that organization. And, you know, you heard about a suicide in Third Maw or one 29 Palms. Well, every single one of them hits the commandant's desk every day. And it's how do you, what can you do after 40 years in the Marine Corps and you're at the top of this and you're trying to do something? And again, it ain't for the way people are going to think of us. It's because they actually care. And that 8-day report was a way to try and do something overtly, get information, disseminate. And the other one was, how do you get people to know their people better? And I don't know if the second part has been successful. I don't know if the first part's been successful. But, you know, I used to have people bitching me about those 8-day reports because one of my jobs was to spank people when they didn't get them in on time. But
do you remember that
every
one,
Will, of them got read by both of the 4-stars.
This was 11 or 12. Do you remember it?
You know, off of the top of my head, I don't, Jeff, because unfortunately I read probably fucking 300.
Like a million of them, yeah.
Right. And I believe it was General Dunford that instituted the 8-day report, wasn't it?
It was, I think it was right in that time period. I think that there was something that needed to be done and it got a little more formal, but I don't know that for a fact either.
I thought it was when he was ACMAC. That's when that got instituted.
We had a thing called the it was like the Force Preservation Board.
Right.
So it looked at all kinds of different stuff: accidents, training, deaths, suicide, and it may have been one of the things that came out of that there was disparate sort of reporting that didn't necessarily coalesce in one place. And it may have been something that the safety guys sort of recommended because they'd seen a industry best practice. I don't even know. And it may have come at that point, but I know, they came up there. We read them. The commandant read them. So, and it was something that got discussed.
You told me that John Vandegrift
at that level,
I would believe it.
if they could put trends or data together.
You told me General Vandegrift.
Yeah, I know in '88 when we had ours, we did a JAG manual. That was all it was required.
Right.
It seemed like it was. I got a hold of the XO of. I can't remember. It was either First Marines or Fifth Marines, because he had done a few of them, a couple of them. And I can't remember his name now, who it was then. But he kind of walked me through how to do it. But yeah.
As we kind of wind this conversation up about suicide, what are your thoughts on it? Just a general question. Your thoughts on this trend that seems to be increasing in our culture, that young people aren't afraid of it, now older people aren't afraid, to end their life anymore. Will, thoughts on suicide?
I struggled in the Marine Corps on, what do you do? And how do you intervene earlier? And I think, some of the suicide prevention training is very good in that there's some sort of classic signs when people talk about it, et cetera. But it's weird how we are as a society now. People expose all kinds of intimate details of their life on social media, but I don't know that people have conversations anymore, right? How many times you go into a restaurant and you see two people sitting there both looking at their phones and they're not even talking? And so how do you do, what Kiker sort of talked about today, and that people seem to be more comfortable in a distant way of opening up as opposed to a face-to-face way. And I'll tell you, we have some very mixed messages in the Marine Corps as well. So much of the force is married. You're not intimately living together. I mean, I was very lucky in First LER when we deployed, and that my jump command group was a fighting platoon. And I knew those guys, Lance Corporals, Corporals, Sergeants, better than a whole lot of guys that I, when I was a company commander. I got to know those guys better. But then again, that was 24/7. Kind of a thing. And it's, I mean, I struggle with it in the service. And I can't say it's had a big impact or it's something I deal with a lot, since I've been out. People need to have a private life, and we have this thing about privacy in the country. But on the other hand, you got to be connected, and I'll roll it into a current event. I think I've said it on the show before. I hate the term social distance, right? Of all the times that you don't want social distance, it's when you got something going on of this pandemic. You might want physical distance, but when you socially distance from people, you get into a place where if people got demons, those demons are going to take over.
Right.
And so how do we get closer socially because I'll tell you, social media doesn't help. Social media does not get us closer socially.
No.
Right?
Right.
And so I don't know. That was a long-winded, winding way of saying I have no idea where we are.
No, but it was.
I can't frame the problem.
Right. No, but what? But I think your observations are ones that I would echo, that I see all the time. You know, the facing movement that gets you in front of that door that leads to really bad shit is isolation. And that cell phone that we all have, that's not a device that connects us. It really isolates us. It's used more for isolation than it is for connection.
Yeah, Steve Jobs is in like the eighth ring of hell for inventing that thing.
Right.
He absolutely is.
No, I agree. And that, you know, and again, to me, the most meaningful statistic in all of that is, in spite of all the naked selfies that are floating around the internet, young people are having less sex than ever. How could that be? And the answer is, if you read about it, is that they don't have relationships with people anymore, right? They don't know how to go up and talk to them. They don't know how to do that. The interpersonal part of it, you know, the electronic part, okay. So it is a, and then you can see in the Marine Corps when, you know, you stop having formations at the company level where senior staff NCOs are scrutinizing and wire brushing everybody, and now novices are supervising novices. You can see that you're on the path to isolating them more. And you can see how that's a contributory factor in all of that. So, no, what you're saying, Will, I mean, is spot on, and I don't think you know how right you are. But, Timmy, your thoughts.
Hey,
go ahead.
Let me just say last thing. You know, a big push in the Marine Corps in the last 20-odd years is barracks. You know?
More privacy.
Greater privacy, right. Et cetera. And Jeff and I, when we were in 3-8 at Geiger, we were an open squad base.
Right.
And you want to know people live in a squad bay together. So,
it's
one of those things. We think we're doing the right thing, but maybe we're not. I don't know.
Yeah. Got it. Timmy, thoughts on suicide?
Fully concur on the open squad bay. And I was thinking, you know, when I went through OCS, not in my platoon, but another platoon, one of the candidates wandered off in the middle of the night. They found him walking down the railway, heading south, somewhere near Fredericksburg by the time they caught up to him. And he was mentally discharged as being not up to material. I never thought about the guys like that dropped. And when we had suicide in 88, you know, at the time, suicide to us was sort of like those guys that couldn't quite hack it, you know, that dropped at OCS. This is somebody that had some type of defect that slipped through, you know. I mean, granted, his horrific childhood was bad, but at the same time, we didn't think about it as anything other than a significant moral flaw, I believe, on the part of the individual, right? And in the 90s, when they started mandating suicide training in the Marine Corps, I remember this because we were in Okinawa. I believe it was in response to a cluster of events in high schools across the nation, causing a focus on that. At the time, the story with the military was, well, they've got less per capita because they psychologically screen all their candidates coming in. We were much less per capita in our age groups than the civilians, much less. It's not true for retired military. It has never been true, but that's not the point here. Because we've changed now, you know, we've changed now to the point where I don't think that suicide is necessarily a mental defect. I don't know how dark place you were in, Matt, when you said it might have made sense to you. But I've certainly been in a dark enough place that it certainly made a little bit of sense to me, and which fortunately I was alarming enough to me to cause me to take immediate action. In the form of running my fat ass down along the seashore. And so I think that we've changed as a society and we view this thing not now as a defect and an inevitability due to weak genes or something similar to that, but as a problem that we can address and fix and actually start saving lives, which we don't have to theorize on. Your talk with Matt Kiker was a perfect demonstration of exactly that. That the capability of engaging this thing as a disease that could strike people that have, whether it's a genetic predisposition or not, but it strikes people. It strikes a lot of goddamn people. And it's worthy of the endeavor you are making to cut this shit off at the source by arming people with the knowledge before they go through life. Because life is trauma. Life, you're going to suffer. Nobody gets out of this shit unscathed. Nobody. And how you handle it, it determines how you're going to end up in life.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When we were kids, it was such a rare occurrence, right? But we didn't talk about it. Like, if you asked your mom about it, like, Mom, like, well, what happened? And you would get the, we're not sure, but it's not something we talk about. You know what I'm saying? I mean, yeah. It's not like your mom would sit you down and say, well, let's have a conversation about suicide. I mean, I don't know anybody whose mom who did that. I don't know anybody who, hey, like, holy shit, man, my mom, like, flipped me out last night. I asked about, you know, like, Mr. Edmonds, who was going to kill himself, who killed himself, and we had this two-hour conversation about it. No moms did that. It was just, like, not something we talked about it. Clearly somebody had some problems, but it wasn't spoken about in, you know, polite society. And I think, I mean, what's healthy, you know, for everybody is to, you know, is to listen to Matt Kiker say, I thought it was a bitch move, man. I thought it was a pussy. And you're like, you're sitting there listening to it and like, holy shit. But like, as I said before, if that's what it takes to scare you off, then you're not really interested in helping anybody. Because if you're afraid to listen to him speak from his heart, then you should go do something else and leave helping people to somebody else. Anyway, Jeff, thoughts about suicide?
Yeah, well, I agree with you. And I didn't even hear any of that fucking bullshit or any of that shit he said because, you know, to me, that's how we talk, you know? And I hear what you're saying about, you know, that if you get wrapped around that axle. But I have to tell you, because he sounds just like another corporal. You know, he's like a guy sounding since
right.
1975, you know? But here's one thing. He actually hit on the head on this, too. He said, it's the feeling of being alone, you know, I think that really that it turns the corner for people going to commit suicide. I'm by myself in this. Somehow they work that around their head. They're like Travis Bickle, the taxi driver, you know, it's like, I'm God's lonely man. And somehow, you know, whether it's, whether they're mentally ill, whether they're emotionally, you know, stressed, you know, whether they're like, they've had a series of, body blows to their, you know, what they feel is their good fortune, like a kid who committed suicide out there in SOI, you know, whatever it is, they feel alone all of a sudden. So I think if you're in an organization, you know your people after a while, you should encourage, if you're a lieutenant, that your squad leaders know those fire team leaders and through them, you know, their fire team members, and those fire team leaders, how, you know, you talk to them regularly about their guys, you know. That was a good thing about being on ship. I could talk to all my guys constantly without calling a goddamn formation, right, which they stopped listening to after the first 3 minutes anyway. Even if you're given the Gettysburg Address, which actually only took a minute and a half.
I know. I was going to say, Lincoln knew what he was doing. He knew his audience.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, but you know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, but then you could, you know, you're talking to two or three of them at a time. You know, in the bow of the ship, you know, or in the, you know, the upper V or whatever, you know, you're talking to them. And that's how you talk to your people. That's how you get to know them. And the fact you're doing it, if you're a company commander, you know, or a platoon commander, means that probably, you know, your squad leader is going to do it, especially if they know you want them to do it. And there's nothing wrong with doing it, you know. And so you have a guy who's usually very, you know, ebullient type guy who's, you know, talks a lot and, you know, has things to say. And all of a sudden he stops. That's the type of guy that there's an alarm. Because you got some guys who are just naturally reticent. They don't talk a lot. So you don't immediately assume the guy's, you know, about to whack himself. Right. But if all of a sudden he starts talking about suicide, you know, it's the change from the norm, I think, that should alarm you. And the whole thing, though, comes down to when you have a unit, you know, it is your unit and it's your job to know them as good as possible as you can. So you can employ them within their capabilities, and at the same time, you need to enhance those capabilities. And in doing that, you're going to get to know them. But you can't know everybody. And the higher you get, the less personal you're going to know the mass of your folks. So you got to encourage that type of philosophy below. That's the only hope, you know, that it'll go. I mean, just like Tim said, you know, we didn't have this. I mean, when I first came to the Marine Corps, the big problem with death was we murdered each other a lot more, you know, and the suicide thing was so rare, but now it's not. Now it's flip-flopped, you know. So it's just it comes down to knowing your people and knowing that difference. And a guy, knowing him good enough to know when there's a difference, you know, that should set up an alarm.
You know, and one final comment, and then we'll go about around and talk about what we're reading. But, you know, a lot of times people are reluctant to talk about this stuff. And so I started doing this, you know, 20 months ago. And I don't know, about 6 months into it, I had a conversation with 2/8 battalion commander. And he said, I asked, you know, well, give me your feedback. Will Marines talk? And he's the guy that said, will they talk? They're like Chatty Cathy on steroids, man. They won't shut the fuck up. And so to me, one of the interesting things that has happened to me in all of this is, you know, they joined the Marine Corps to meet leaders that would give a shit about them. I believe that. And they're waiting for us to come have these conversations. And then I think we fall short because of, you know, we don't want to intrude on them. We don't want to go there. But they're waiting for us to go there. And that's, to me, what's so interesting about this is that, you know, you wouldn't know, you know, as Will said at the start, Matt Kiker's trauma, none of it has anything to do with the Marine Corps. It's all in his personal life. And yet, why is this guy off the rails? I just talked to General Neller again earlier this week, you know, and we were talking, and he said 80-90% of the Marines that commit suicide have never even deployed, which means we got to get to them, and we got to know them, as Dave says, we got to know them better, and we got to do that sooner. And if we do that, then we at least put ourselves in a position, you know, to make a difference in their lives. And I think that the other thing I think that, you know, that interview confirmed for me was, you know, if you just be a Marine with them, and even with civilians, if you don't sugarcoat it and just tell them the truth, they get that, because everybody's sick and tired of being told bullshit. Time heals all wounds. No, it fucking doesn't. Right? And so to me, if you lead with the truth, you give yourself a chance to continue that conversation. But if you lead with bullshit, 90% chance you'll never hear from them again, because they've heard too much of it in their life. So anyway, any final comments before we talk about what we're reading? All right, Will, what are you reading?
Yeah, I just read a book called The End of October. It was written by Lawrence Wright. He's the guy that wrote Looming Tower, about how we got to 9/11, and then Terror years sort of after. This is a novel he wrote, and believe it or not, it's about a flu pandemic, and it's sort of an interesting work. He puts a lot of lefty stuff in there, which is distracting. But he projects that the pandemic in this book is 1,000 times worse than what we've sort of seen. But he gets in there to a lot of things about mentality of people and unpreparedness, perhaps, as it goes on. And it's an interesting story, and it's set at about this time, maybe just a few years in the future, and he wrote it just a couple years ago. So The End of October, pretty interesting book. And if you feel bad about, you know, COVID, just read this book and you'll realize, you know, we're in happy lands compared to what potentially it could have been.
Got it. Tim, what are you reading?
Well, I mentioned last week that I had been alerted that there was another naval historian from a generation behind us named Ian W. Toll, and he had written a trilogy on the Pacific War. And so I started the first one, Pacific Crucible. Having just read Neptune's Inferno, I wanted to compare the two of them. I still think it's freaky that these two guys who are 10, 12 years our junior are writing like this. And I want to tell you that Pacific Crucible, That's another excellent story. And he's painting in details that are absent from Neptune's Inferno. He takes a little bit of a running start from before, and he focuses on different aspects. And I'm learning all kinds of things I had no knowledge of, you know. And I couldn't enjoy it more. In fact, I have to ration my time with it because I won't do my homework. So I've got to meet a goal, homework goal, before I let myself start reading. I can read that damn thing all night. It is outstanding, awesome history, and just very readable.
Jeff, what are you reading?
Well, I said I'm reading the book that Will recommended, and I'm reading the book that Timmy just mentioned, Neptune's Inferno. And I have to tell you, the Gilbert book about the Holocaust, it's very comprehensive. And I have it on Kindle, so I don't have like a book that I could see how, but I got an idea. It's massive. Is it massive, Will? Because I'm in the part about Poland now, and it is going through almost every it's going through Eastern Poland. It's going through Western Poland, you know, how things are different, how they worked out, if they're going to let Jews cross over to the Russian zone, you know, because the Russians stabbed the Poles in the back in 1939. And, you know, so it's very comprehensive and it's very good, you know, because I'm into that type of detail on that stuff. But it does get depressing because it's murder and criminality after murder and criminality, you know. And then I'm reading that Neptune's Inferno. I just finished the part about the Battle of Savo Island, which happened on August 8th, the day after we landed at Guadalcanal. And we got our ass kicked by the Japanese. One of the COs kind of almost chickened out. One of the captains of the heavy cruisers, you know, almost chickened out. And the other one was convinced that the whole thing was blue on blue, fire at first. And so even though he knew, you know, intellectually it was the Japanese, he kept sending out these messages. Hey, you know, if this is a mistake, I'm sorry, you know, but I mean, his ship was sunk. It was just awful. And the other thing about Neptune's Inferno, it's stuff that you don't really think about, but was a key, like all those battleships we had, they were gas hogs. They were fuel hogs to the max. And most of them after Pearl Harbor, they sent them to San Pedro, where they sat, you know, and most of the fighting that was done subsequent to Midway was done by these mid-sized, surface ships who were fighting their asses off. Until they built the North Carolina, came out in 1942. It was like a fuel efficient version of a battleship that wouldn't, suck too much of the fuel away. So it's very interesting. You know, we started, all of us, I think, from the starting point of Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors. And it's just started, a flame of interest in me about this type of thing, which is good because my dad and my Uncle Chet, who I mentioned, you know, about, they both were, surface Navy guys in World War II. So it's very interesting to me.
You know, one of the interesting things about the Battle of Samar is the way they tracked the Japanese fleet at the end of 1943 into 1944, the way they understand operationally what's going on is by tracking the movement of Japanese tankers.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how they knew something was up, you know, that was going to happen in the vicinity of the Philippines. And, you know, they had the three major task force ready and waiting. And then we kind of screwed it up, and then Taffy 3 pulls it out of their ass while somebody else is away chasing carriers. So interesting. All right. Well, first of all, guys, I want to say thank you for your. I always enjoy this stuff, and I've learned to enjoy kind of our. I don't even know what to call these things when we talk about death and we talk about suicide. I've learned to enjoy them. Maybe more than I enjoy what we normally argue about, because I don't know. I just think that for me, they have more meaning. I know they resonate with the people that listen a shit ton, because everybody who listens deals with the same stuff we deal with in their lives too. And when you hear people talking, you know, all you guys talking about your lives, you know, Will, the loss of Carrie, you know, Tim, what you struggled through in terms of your homelessness and ideating, and Jeff, your wounds and your struggle to recover after that shit and all the stuff that's happened in your life and sharing that. I don't know, for some reason, these things are more special than others. And so I just want to thank you all for your candor always. I know it inspires people because they tell me it does. So thank you for coming on and once again talk about your lives. I appreciate it.
No worries, buddy.
All right. See you guys.
All right. There you have it. Tim Lynch, Jeff Kinney, and Will Constantini. Constantini. I want to put an N in there. I'm sorry about that. Anyway. That'll do it on a Thursday here. If you're just tuning in, whatever the hell you do, don't touch that dial because, you're about to hear one of the best interviews I've ever done in my life. Maybe the best, I'm not sure, but it's certainly up there. It's an interview. The first thing you're going to hear is you're going to hear something that I play in Post-Traumatic Winning, and it's Matt Kiker talking about a little bit about himself. So I want you to listen to that. And then that's about 4 minutes and some odd seconds. And then you're going to hear, when you hear Sweet Home Alabama, you'll hear the interview I did with Matt Kiker. So don't touch that dial. And then you'll hear this. And today is the 10th World Suicide Prevention Day. And so we're talking about suicide, something that, is growing in our culture. And what do we do about it? How do we help people? And so that's what today's show is about. And so the interview with Matt Kiker is an incredible interview about what's possible. If you're not afraid to have a conversation, if you're not afraid to be honest with people, and what they can do, so don't touch that dial. So on a Thursday, on this day when the world talks about how to prevent suicide, don't be afraid to change somebody's life. And you can tell, as Libby Weichel said, you can hear the joy in his voice, and that's what you're going to hear when you hear Matt Kiker. So. Have a great day on a Thursday. All Marine Radio, out.